die 17. Bildkunst-Kameragespräche mit dem Träger des Marburger Kamerapreises 2015, Ed Lackman. Das zweite Gespräch führte Daniel Kotenschulte. Die Sichtung der Filme La Souvrière von Werner Herzog und Report from Hollywood von Edward Lackman wird empfohlen.
Ja, vielen Dank. Ich erlaube mir, Englisch zu sprechen für dahin. Aber Sie sind übrigens alle herzlich eingeladen, auch Fragen zu stellen. Auch wenn wir am Anfang vielleicht selber reden, aber das heißt ja nicht, dass man nicht auch Fragen stellen kann und vor allen Dingen ganz viele dann auch bald darauf, in gleich welcher Sprache, das kriegen wir schon hin. Hello, Ed. So good to see you again. And it's so good to see something for the first time. This film I just saw for the first time. And that was a rare treat. And if you said in the beginning that you felt embarrassing for something, I don't see any reason to feel that way. And if so, it was all my fault, because I wished so much for this film to be played here that I told everybody that they should try to find it. And you found it before us at the Munich Film Museum. And this is the first screening in 30 years, as far as I know.
Maybe it was the only screening. Because I think when Vim saw it, he goes, what is this, Eddie? You know, like the girl in bed with you and the guy on the street. That, you know. So I don't know. It was just like being young and trying to like make your own kind of film. And I don't know, being inspired by, you know, European and American cinema and what I loved about what the Germans were doing in the 70s and, you know, being involved with all that, that from the outside, obviously. I really worked with those directors outside of Germany in the United States. Even the film with Schlondorf was Gathering of Old Men. That was a film that he shot in the South. Probably the only I did do a couple things in Germany. Maybe the one thing, this last train to Harrisburg, that was here in Munich, in München. But yeah, the irony of it is, in a strange way, Aeroflex bought the lab, the building that the lab was in, where they had their equipment center. And they sent out a letter, and the negative was in the lab at Aeroflex, and they gave like 3 months, and I never saw the letter or whatever, and like they threw out the negative. So it was always in the back of my mind, where I knew there was like three prints. One was sold to the New South Wales Film Commission in Australia. I had one that I don't know where it went, and one went to Munich, which, thank God, when filmmakers make, I don't know if it's still true, but when filmmakers get state money, they have to give a print to the state or the film museum as for posterity. And I found out that they had one print at the film museum. And then it took me like 2 years to negotiate with them to let me take the print out, do a digital transfer, and give it back to them. I don't know what they think. And I even said to them, I'll pay for it, which I did, and I'll give you the, you know, a corrected answer print. So there is, I think, the later print of this where there are subtitles, so you know who the people are. I mean, you know, like the girl, the woman has nothing to do with the film, but she's an actress in Hollywood that I knew. And she mentions Frances, but that's really Frances Ford Coppola she was having a relationship with. But at the time, and then the images in the beginning of the Las Vegas scene is really images from One from the Heart. I had done a film with Godard, and we had shot on the set, and I had that negative, and so I took one shot out of the negative and put it in the film because I thought it was emblematic of like Hollywood kind of filmmaking. So anyway, that.
And therefore, Chris Sivanek is wearing this shirt, Alpha Will, which is also a Godard quote, but he was doing that voluntarily, I suppose.
Yeah, that was just coincidental. I mean, the best things happen in documentaries because they happen by chance. And then obviously in the editing, you try to find those relationships to tell something about the story. And So, and even the black and white of Wim's film, that's off his editing machine. You know, back then we worked on Steenbecks or Chems, so I photographed that off of the Chem. So it was very kind of like handmade, the film. And I was worried that the sound wouldn't come through because it came off of a print optical track, but it... you can understand Viv?
I understood every single word he was saying, and well, I think the sound looks great because I mean, there's this kind of cheap score to it, and the cheap score really makes sense with, you know, in this optical sound track, and my opinion, it really made sense altogether. I don't know. I don't want to criticize anything about the film, but
time heals everything.
Anyway, when I saw it, I was wondering about an inspiration that Wim and you might have in common, and that's Robert Frank's photography, the view of America, as you know, when Frank made this book in America in the 50s, it was about a prosperous country somewhat in a state of sleep, waiting for something else to happen. People were feeling, looking lonely and not really satisfied in the pictures. And that's exactly how, you know, this picture of Hollywood appears to be. There's something, and actually this is what the state of things is about. So in my opinion, I was wondering whether you talked about that with Wim, or is it just a coincidence that there is something, that there was...
We were talking yesterday. I mean, Robert Frank and Larry Clark were the two still photographers that I was most enamored by and interested in, and then later William Eggleston. But certainly Robert Frank is always a reference for me visually, because he always sees behind the thing, you know, behind the gloss and you know, the isolation of people. So, and visually, and also that he's a photographer that always found his own language kind of a poetic metaphor for what he was looking at. You know, he used the American flag, he used jukeboxes. You go through his books and you see reoccurring themes, you know. And so he's 94, and we became actually good friends.
That's good to know. Wonderful. But did you know of Eggleston's work back then?
I'm sure I knew of Eggleston's work back then, yeah. Because, you know, at that time, you know, like Robbie Muller and Wim, you know, were exploring like an American Friend, and this was after American Friend. You know, I call it the 70s large format photographers in America, like Mitch Epstein and Len Gentile, and so certainly they were aware of, you know, Robert Frank, of, you know.
Yeah, because it was only 1975 when Eggleston had this big show at the MoMA and became well known to people. I was not there, so I cannot confess if it's true or false, but actually you were very up to date to actually being aware of Stephen Shore and Eggleston, which is quite obvious in this film. There's this wonderful color shot of Wim Wenders driving the car in the end of the film, which has a very warm color to it, some evening light, and it's long enough on the screen that we can have, you know, this view of this image as a photo as well as a scene. You know, this is something that's so essential with Wim's films. You know that. If they work, then you get this feeling of watching both an image and a story. And I mean,
well, the thing about like Wim's language, his images, and Robbie's images that I was always taken by was their favorite lens was a 25 millimeter lens and 35 millimeter. And the wonderful thing about a 35, even in close-ups, you can see near-far relationships. In other words, the person or the, you know, what he's photographing, there's always a relationship to the environment. And that became really a trademark for me of Wim and Robbie's work together, that even from, you know, Alice in the City, back then they actually shot that in 16 millimeter, and they used, I would think, a 12.5 millimeter, which would be comparable to a 25 millimeter and 35. But they created their own language with this lens, and it was a wonderful, this lens is wonderful because it, like I say, you can show a certain amount of depth of focus, but also you can show how the characters are, I don't know, that you can make a statement about who these are because of the architecture and the landscape that they're in. They're not isolated by the frame. The frame is opened up to make those spatial relationships to who they are, what they are. And, you know, strangely enough, you know, when I look at Ulrich Seidel, he does the same thing, you know, but in Super 16. And he primarily shoots 95, 90 more with a 9.5 millimeter. And then rarely he'll put a 12.5 on for the close-up. Another photographer that Vim referenced, or filmmaker Ozu with Tokyo Ga, which I really wanted to show here, always used a 50 millimeter. And, you know, that came out of, you know, again, that's the way he saw the world. Well, he feels a 50 millimeter is the vision, the peripheral vision of how we see. Some people say it's a 40 millimeter, but Ozu felt it was a 50 millimeter. And then another wonderful film, I don't know why I'm going off on this, but like The Last Picture Show was by Bruce Surtees, was all shot with a 32 millimeter. I always get that wrong. I don't know if it's 32 or 40 millimeter, but they shot it all with one lens.
How about Todd Solondz's work? He's also very much into giving people space to occupy and not following the action in a very...
I did this one film with Todd, and I actually, it was a very good experience, but I never felt his films were very visual. He's comes from writing and with the actors. And he was very strong as a storyteller and as a very specific, you know, he did Happiness and Welcome to the Dollhouse, and he's very dry, ironic. He's kind of, I always call him the Woody Allen of the independent world. And so he was more open to like playing with me with what I was doing with the camera. And I mean, for him, strangely enough, someone was talking and then you have a line. His idea is you just pan over to the other person. I go, that's a lot of negative space to go between this character and that character. You can do it in a cut. And so I got him to think in cuts rather than just always making moves back and forth between two people.
That came from you. That's very good to know.
Well, that film.
Anyway, this is my feeling of contemporary Hollywood cinema, that you see so little pictures in them, in my opinion. It's just following the action or occupying or putting it on film, what happens. And actually, it's a way, in a way, Wim Wenders describes this in that film. He says American movies are just filmed screenplays, which of course, it's not that, it was not always true, but right now I have a feeling that I like to go to the movies because of the images, because of the pictures. I wanted to see pictures. And it becomes rarer and rarer and rarer, mm-hmm. unless I see a film that you photographed.
Well, there's others. I see on the marquee they have Birdman. That's a wonderful visual film. No, I think what happens in Hollywood, or has happened in Hollywood, because there were different periods of time when it was much richer visually, is that, you know, they're shooting for the editing room. You know, there's this idea that there's coverage, and the way you shoot the scene can be manipulated later. And I think photography has to be about a point of view in the storytelling. Where you put the camera is how the viewer, the audience, is going to experience the scene. And so you have to make that interpretation when you're shooting, and then stick to it and not try to cover yourself. So Hollywood, you know, it's a very expensive medium to make films, and they want to know they have coverage every which way, you know. And then I think a lot of filmmakers, out of insecurity, do over-cover things, even if they shoot a moving master. So the whole scene takes place in one shot, let's say. Then they say, but I need the close-ups in case it doesn't work. So, you know, for a cameraman, that's always kind of debilitating, because, you know, you spend all this time and energy to make it work that way. And I'm lucky enough to work with people like Paul Schrader. I think we're going to show that film with him later, where he thinks and cuts. So one shot develops into the next shot. And then there are close-ups, but he knows in his head, this is where that piece of film is going to be a close-up. So I don't have to shoot the whole scene in a wide shot with the same dialogue to then cut into the close-up. He says, that's the part of the scene I want to be closer to the actor. So I think it's more, let's say, an industrial way of making a film. And I think that's why I was so drawn to the German cinema in the 70s, is because the filmmakers found that they could have their own individual voice for the kind of stories they wanted to tell, and that they created their own language, like a painter, you know, that you would have a specific point of view. And maybe it also comes out of television, you know, that television, you know, you're photographing for a smaller screen, so you don't think you're going to be able to play certain images as long as you would for on a movie screen, and that dictates a certain stylization. But you know, if I look at America, what filmmakers are strong visually, certainly Todd Haynes thinks about the language of images to tell a story. Well, he's Mexican, who directed Birdman, and the cinematographer, Chivo. Americans, that's a good one. Well, we could say, you know, Down by Law.
Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, Jim Jarmusch, you know, there's got to be others. I'm blanking.
I mean,
if you look back in the 70s, there was some great imagistic, you know, filmmakers, you know, and Frankenheimer was a strong visualist. Michael Mann was a great visualist.
Since this film has some kind of cultural pessimism to it, when it comes to speaking of black and white cinema, they say, well, it's a dying art form. And that, of course, reminded me of how we speak about celluloid film today. It's a dying art form. And still, there's some progress in television, because the television screens are getting bigger. The studios are better that produce television films now. And you made a wonderful example with Todd Haynes, Mildred Pierce, which is one of the great examples of the excellency in cable television. That we call now the renaissance of television.
Well, HBO, yeah. They're taking greater chances with different kind of material that isn't purely contrived as being commercial, or I say video games or amusement rides. You know, most of Hollywood, you know, want to figure out how they can franchise the next blockbuster or comic book strip. And so HBO is taking a chance to, well, they're people want other alternatives to what they're looking at, you know, and there's an audience, and so they're creating the best material right now, HBO.
So what is your mood now towards the future of cinema or television? Are you're never a pessimist, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here.
I'm getting out of it. You know, we're going to talk about the digital world. You know, for me, or I know a lot of my friends here, you know, we're now involved in a digital world, and it's a mixed blessing. I think for documentaries, it's a wonderful form, because it decreases, you know, the technical aspect, and it's more about the subject matter, and so you don't have to be as conscious about having as much light or the heaviness of the equipment, and it's more, can I say, inconspicable. You know, I mean, but saying all that, Michael Neubauer was bringing up that it's also taking the input into what our job is about creating images for the story, is that now everybody thinks they see what is on the frame to tell the story, that it doesn't, you know, that we can just shoot, you know, you have an image, well, you know, I see it digitally on the monitor, we can shoot. Well, but that isn't necessarily the image that you want to create. It might be an image, but it isn't necessarily the image that you want to create for the thematic of the storyline. And then the other part of the digital world that becomes complicated is in the post-production, because now the director can sit in with a cinematographer and make adjustments to the density and the light and the color that maybe you didn't build in or try to obtain when you were shooting the film. And also then there's an inconsistency. You know, they see one shot and they want to do it one way and another shot another way. And part of what our job is about the consistency of a style and a look. And so I had a very frustrating situation in the last film in where I always love shadow detail, you know, or in highlights, I like to hold the highlights. And I had a director that wanted to crush everything so I would lose the shadow detail. And we had originated in the film and the negative on film. So I had it in the film. But then when you crush it digitally, you can never get it back. So it was kind of a back and forth situation. So, and it was always a delay in film. In other words, you would look at the print with the director, with the timer, the man that does the color with you at the lab and the density. You would look at it together, and then he would leave, and then you would have a discussion with a colorist, and then he would work on it, and sometimes you would go in the room with him and work with him over a light box or off the screen, and then the director would come back. And I always found that delay of a day or two or 3 days with the director, they would forget somewhat visually. It's hard to remember exactly visually what you were saying that you wanted that day. And then when they come back and they see something that works and that you know, is partly your vision, they go, yeah, that's great. That's what I wanted. But that immediacy of them sitting in the room with you is, that takes away that distance to be able to show them what you're doing. And that's makes it very complicated.
Actually, I have a few clips from other documentaries that you directed, but I hesitate to show the first two of them because the quality is YouTube quality. Would you mind? Or it's,
I don't care. You, whatever.
Because we have
I'm
so many DPOs in the audience who would mind, but just to give them an idea.
Whatever.
The first two clips are Say Amen Somebody.
Say Amen Somebody.
And
gospel music.
And Karajan in Salzburg.
Oh, wow.
Can I have a question?
Yes, sure. Sorry.
Should I, Mike?
Sure.
I said Michael Mann. I didn't mean Michael Mann. Who is the first object with the Western rawhide?
Because before we change to other films, I want to point out that I found The Report of Hollywood quite an interesting film because it's double meter reflexive, so to say, because perhaps not everybody knows that Wenders' experience in Hollywood, he refers in the film, was actually his shootings for Hammett, for Francis Ford Coppola. And that was a production where Francis Ford Coppola, for the first time, tried to realize his idea of electronic cinema. So that gave him a strong power to control the production, and Wenders really get crazy out of it, and it was a really terrible production for him. And the Stand of Things was a reaction of Wenders on his shooting with Coppola and Hammett, where he actually tried to show, and he also make short remarks in your film about his terrible experience in Hollywood. And so it's really a wonderful film with these double mere reflections on production conditions and the difference between European and American productions. And I thought that should be pointed out.
Also, there's a part of Lightning Over Water, or I guess here you call it Nick's movie, that Wim is also dealing with that, because he's saying in the film it's kind of a documentary, docudrama, some whatever. It's a mixture of, you know, documentary and fiction. He comes back from L.A. to make this film with Nick, and obviously it's Hammett. So he's referencing that in both of these films. And I made an error before. I didn't mean Michael Mann. I meant Anthony Mann. So I just correct that.
And I couldn't agree more. It's so great that we have a film that actually it's about filmmaking again, and about making these two films that are about filmmaking. Amazing. So just 5 minutes of clips of...
He had to approve the cinematographer. So the only reason he approved me was because I had worked with Werner Herzog. I don't know if he ever saw any films from Werner Herzog, but that was good enough. And so he then invited me to his house. He had a... like in Anhalt, I don't know if you know Austria at all, but it's like this very conservative, like Swiss chalet, little town, little dorf. And he took me into his basement, and he then showed me on a Steenbeck films that he had been making of him conducting from the 50s, different pieces of music. And he did this because he wanted to show me how he wanted to be lit. And he wanted, like, light coming from heaven. It was like this strong 10K backlight. Maybe it was a 5K. And he was glowing, you know, like he was coming from the heavens. And that's the way he wanted to be lit. Obviously, we didn't light him that way. We just used the available light on the stage, and, you know, maybe in rooms, you know, I bounced a 1K. But he was very aware, you're right, about, and also that his legacy, that he would leave this legacy visually of him conducting these pieces. So he was very savvy. And you remind me of this one instant. They were rehearsing, and I was in the pit with the musicians, and maybe I touched the first violinist. And the first violinist stopped. And I know some German. In German, he said to von Karajan, either I leave or he leaves. And von Karajan said, you leave. And then once when I was on the stage, I maybe got a little close to him and he looked at me. And I like fell to my knees with a camera. So in these situations, and I know there's a lot of documentary cameramen, sometimes you're just forced into one situation. I couldn't move around a lot. I had maybe two other cameramen for the performances, but the days that they would just rehearse, it would just be me. And so I would try to pick a position. I always say there's a psychological distance to capturing people. So I always think you start far away from someone and then slowly you move in. You don't go right up to them. And that's what I did with von Karajan. Is I knew there's always kind of a psychological distance where you invade someone's privacy or awareness. They know you're there, but there's still some kind of distance. And it's hard to explain what that distance is. It's different for different people. And the other thing about documentary or reportage is there's an immediate response, or I don't want to say response, intuition about how you see someone, and then later what you think about that person, is it become true or not, you know? And because I think we instantaneously, with our own prejudice or not, make decisions about each other. And I think that happens photographically, and also people trusting you with a camera. So, and now there's one other thing I wanted to say. Last night, Albert Maysles died, and he was like a father to me, and it's so nice that we're looking at documentaries, because I started really, when I got out of college, I made a film about a therapeutic community for drug addiction, and I edited it at the Maysles Brothers studio, and then he came in the room and we became friends, and he said, do you do sound? And I said, no, I'm a cameraman, and I ended up doing sound with him for 2 years, and then we worked on Cristo's Valley Curtain. I did one of the cameras, and then I worked on Grey Gardens, and I worked with them for a number of years. So, you know, David, his brother, died many years before, but Albert was 88, I think. And I did see him at the New York Film Festival this year. He was a lovely. He always believed, you know, because we're going to talk about documentary, he always believed that documentary was truer than fiction, that the story, you could always find any story in fiction you could find in life. And their style of shooting was the true idea of what cinema verite was, that, you know, came out of the 60s, that, you know, with a small camera and a tape recorder, you know, you could enter people's worlds and life and show truth. Now, obviously, we became very sophisticated and know it's a manipulation of how you shoot someone, how you edit it, that you influence the audience's point of view. But to his dying day, Albert believed that that was what truth was. And they would never really ever tell someone what to do, but once... And if you miss something, he would always say, you'll find it again. It's there. But they would follow. Obviously, they would shoot a lot of film. And once they found the story through the footage, then they would follow that story. You know, they did films like Give Me Shelter, and obviously the killing at Altamont, you know, was the important aspect of that film. But if you look at their films, they always... find something in the filming that then they follow. Anyway,
thanks for this tribute. I had the pleasure of meeting him once, and he was so impressive. And there's something about the culture of their films, a kind of portraiture with the moving camera that I'm missing with most documentaries now. If we see interviews in documentary films, they always put up the camera on the tripod and don't do anything else anymore, most documentary filmmakers. And I wonder why, because it used to be like this. They would follow
probably
faces.
Time and money. You know, it was very expensive to make films that way. And that was the consensus of how you made a documentary, because that style of so-called cinema verite was the style in vogue. And now especially television producing many of these films, there's a timetable to get the content. And so you rely on, you know, the interview and then cutaway footage, you know. But, I mean, there's still independent filmmakers that are making films in this similar vein. But obviously this kind of filmmaking is about observation. And so... that's what's allowing, you know, really cameramen are directing the film in documentaries, you know, because if you have a director telling you where to be at what time, you'll always be behind the action. I did this in concerts, let's say, you know, then they give you the headsets, you know, they're going to talk to the cameraman while they're shooting the concert. I always broke mine, threw it away, because again, I did a film like Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll with Taylor Hackford, and he had never directed or a music film like this, you know, a documentary. It was about Chuck Berry and his relationship to, you know, well, it was Keith Richards paying homage to Chuck Berry, but it was really about Chuck Berry, and it was his 50th anniversary, or I forget what it was, but we were in St. Louis where Chuck Berry was from, and this concert, it was really very complicated, because you had someone, you know, in Hollywood language wanting to direct a documentary, almost, like I say, whoever it is, but being the director, you're always going to be behind the moment, because as a cinematographer in documentaries, I used to keep my one eye open because you want to know where you're going next. So you want to make those connections visually when you're shooting, you know, to continuation of time. So I was always thinking about where am I going to go. Now, sometimes you go someplace and it isn't happening, and sometimes it is. Like, maybe I give you an example, like in Report from Hollywood, when I'm on Henri Alcan, the cinematographer, and there's that altercation with a woman in the car with Vim, and I wanted to show the awkwardness that this you know, Frenchman was having seeing this altercation, and I looked down and I saw his hands playing with his contrast glass. So at some moment I panned down, you know, and because I always think that the camera is an extension of your eye. So we as cinematographers are directing the audience to our eye of what we're experiencing, because to me, images are about the experience we're having, you know, either in a still photograph or in a motion. We're documenting our experience, our relationship, our subjective viewpoint, and you know, that's what I think is the best part of documentary. And you know, someone that they've honored here, like Wolfgang Thaler, is a wonderful handheld cameraman, or Chris Doyle. You know, there's someone, and not all cinematographers have that. They, you know, they might be very good in, you know, a stage situation, but it takes a rare, it's a different sensibility of responding to what's happening in front of you at the time. And you're making choices all the time, you know. Anyway, I enjoy that the most. You know, somebody was asking me yesterday about what kind of films do I enjoy. My background was documentary, and I probably enjoy that style of shooting the best, because it empowered what we do. You know?
Actually, in early cinema, there was not a distinction, because the cinema was a sensation, whether it was real or staged. I mean, it was sensational, and a great documentary, in my opinion, is still sensational. And so, I mean, we have questions from the audience. I wouldn't like to miss them. But yeah, please.
Thank you. Last night we have seen Ken Park, and I have a question to you, because the director is a photographer, and you are mentioned as a co-director. Just I wanted to know how you did work together.
Everybody here, I heard the question. All right. Well, Larry and I are both photographers. The script, I approached Larry about the idea of, did he have a diary like his books, Tulsa and Teenage Lust, a written diary, like the books were visual, and he did. So neither Larry and I are writers. So, like I said, we found Harmony Korine, and he put it in a certain kind of structure, and the way we actually worked on the set was, I actually worked with the adults, And he worked mostly with the children. And then we would call it workshopping. We would rehearse a lot, but before shooting, let's say a week or 2 weeks, or just hang out with these kids. In fact, it was pretty amazing. You know, here we were in our 50s, and we would be in these parents' home, and we'd be in their bedroom, and the parents didn't think anything of it. But most of these kids were coming from really dysfunctional families. One was kind of a crack addict, you know, and so, in fact, this was interesting. Even we were walking down the street one day with these kids, and they were all skaters, and the police came up and told the kids to get off the side or get off the street and go on the sidewalk, and didn't even look right past us. We didn't exist. It was the strangest experience that we were invisible in a certain world around these kids. But Larry has this incredible ability. I think it's partly because he's never grown out of his own adolescent situation and emotions, that these kids have total trust in his demeanor. And like I say, that kind of trust someone has when you have a camera in front of you. And they knew his work, or he, you know, showed him some of his work. And the question about why the children, or you didn't really ask this, but I'll answer it. why were the kids so comfortable with their own sexuality and expressing it? Well, I think it's partly that our culture, and I don't know necessarily about Germany, is so sexualized anyway through commercialism and pornography, that they were very they were more secure about themselves than, let's say, I would have been growing up. And they understood what we were trying to say, that they live in a world that's predatory and complicated for them emotionally to grow up in, but that there was something pure amongst themselves that they wanted to show. That they created their own family for themselves, especially in this community we were in Visalia in California, outside of southern, you know, Los Angeles, this small rural town. Oh, but did I answer the question? So I really directed through the camera, and then Larry would again, it was more, the film is really observation. We didn't really tell them what to do. We had lines, but we let them go off on what their lines were. Like that one scene where the kids are sitting around, and there's this one kid that talks about his father dying of diabetes, and you see how, you know, what kind of pain that kid is in. I didn't know that kid was going to say that at the moment. So we would set up, later, you know, this is kind of the way I worked with Ulrich, and I think why Ulrich, you know, wanted or thought he could work with me is because he had seen Ken Park. Or even in the scene with the mother. Now, she's an actress. She's actually a daytime actress on television. Never had done anything like this. But she actually kind of, in a way, directed the scene, because she saw this kid was really, confused about what the scene was even about. You know, generally the cliche would be, the kids, you know, having this relationship with this sexy mom, you know, but she saw how lost this kid was, and she was very motherly to him, you know. So, and then that one scene where, that one take, she cries, and that only happened once. So, anyway, that's the same idea about shooting it like a documentary, but not doing it with, you know, hand-hold documentary means, that there was a certain respect for the performance and letting the camera observe rather than participate with it.
So it wasn't it Werner Herzog who saw Ken Park and then approached you about meeting Uri Seil because he thought that you could do better?
Yeah, that was the offhanded compliment. Werner saw it at Telluride and came out and said, not bad, but that's kid stuff to Ulrich Seidel. And then I went to Vienna that year and met Ulrich Seidel and became friendly with him.
No, I like both films equally. Righteous. The great masterpieces. Yeah, there's a question. Might be fun.
This morning we saw the film you shot about in United States, and you did it from a positive print. It was a pretty good work from the laboratory on video, but we admired the structure of film grain, of photography, of everything which was still visible then. Now, do you think there's a new aesthetic of digital images? I don't mean the quality. We will improve the quality soon. Soon we will have no more problems with quality. But do you think there is a special aesthetic of digital image, which is interesting for you?
Yeah, he brings up a very good point. Is there a different, we're not just talking about the technical aspect, but is there a different approach to filmmaking? That's the question. And I think of it this way. When digital editing came in and moviolas and chems and Steenbecks went out, there was a different style of telling stories through editing. Once they realized they could manipulate the image to a greater extent, because, you know, to cut and paste, it would limit, you know, it didn't have to limit, but it did limit it created a certain stylization of editing. In the same way that once Godard told me the reason all films look alike is because there's, you know, 1,000-foot magazines, or you have 300-meter magazines, that films would look different if they were only 100-foot magazines. So it's true, technology does affect kind of stylistic approaches to how you tell a story. So the question is, digitally, is it affecting? Well, I think it is in the sense that people think they can shoot everything and they'll find the story because it's cheap, or, you know, that the digital format allows it yourself to shoot longer takes, you know, where, you know, you're not going to run out of film. I don't know if it makes better stories. You know, the people that are going to work the best in the digital world, let's say like Birdman, are using the digital media to its extent for extended takes, but they had a conceptual idea of how they were using the camera. So it isn't just because you can shoot forever that you're going to have a better story. Now, lighting, it's interesting. On some level, you could say, I think sometimes films look better now than they did because the digital world, that you can see, oh, it's dark, but I have just enough information that I can, it looks good, you know, and everybody can agree. Now, maybe when we were shooting in film, there are people that could do that, but you would protect yourself a little, you know. And now digitally, you know, people looks like they're taking greater chances. But I have a problem on one level about that is, just to make something dark doesn't make it good. And I find there's a visual tendency now in the digital world, in the narrative form, to make things dark. And even like when you read like what Gordon Willis, and he's supposed to be the godfather of darkness, the prince of darkness, he even said, I have a mid-section, a mid-range, and a highlight when I have something dark, so you feel the darkness. If you make everything dark in the scene, your eye gets tired, and it looks to me flat and muddy. So you have to understand what darkness. Darkness exists because there's light. You know, it's about the contrast of the image. So I think there's, like, any time there's technology that people think, oh, that's going to replace our storytelling. It doesn't replace our storytelling, but it does change the way people think that they can do something. And then I think there'll just be a period of time when people will come back to what it's about and not, you know, thinking that I don't need a light meter so it can be dark. You know, it's how you use the camera to tell the story. It isn't, the technology doesn't tell the story.
I remember how music videos were looked upon back then as the end of something, you know, something was, you know, fading away, or the distinction that you make making films, because everything was there for everybody to use. And in the end, it became one of the most influential powers to storytelling in film, in my opinion. And you were actually involved in making music videos for Annie Lennox, for example. There was one question. Oh, yeah. The back row, the guy.
I have a question to the first film we have seen this morning concerning the volcano. I mean, it was obviously that you risked your life making this film, and you interviewed two persons who spoke about the situation. The one was saying, okay, I stay, or if you take me with you, I go to where my children are. I mean, they reflected about the situation. My question is, when you, in this moment, didn't you reflect your own situation, which was nearly the same?
Yeah, well, I think I was too naive. There's two parts, maybe I can answer that. I got a call from Werner like 5 in the morning, and Werner, in his bombastic way of talking, you know, said, there is a volcano in Guadeloupe in the Caribbean, and there are a group of people or one person that resists God and country, and it's going to be the explosion of atomic bomb. Will you go there and make a film? And I said to him, what film stock are we shooting? And then I ended up in Guadeloupe and before Werner did for 3 days. And I go, wow. Now, you know, for this crazy German, I'm in this island that's going to, this volcano. It was shaped like a butterfly. There was one side of the island that was totally evacuated. The other side, there were certain people still living there, basically poor people that couldn't afford to leave. And then when we were on the mountain, he talks about where I lost my glasses. I did ask Werner what would happen if it erupted, you know. That was it. He left me in the town. I did all the shots in town where in the hospital, and then there was a monument to the dead in the war, and the dogs were running around. I had walked around it. That was the first time he left me, and then Yorick and him went up to look for this guy or this group of people. And that's when I said to Werner, what's going to happen if it erupts? What should I do? And he said, go to the pier, go to that dock, and there'll be someone to pick you up. And he left, and I go, who's going to know I'm here to pick me up? So that Werner would never put anybody else in harm's way that he wouldn't put himself, and that gives you a sense of trust. But I was just too naive, and I never would have done this later or now. And what happened out of that is I would get the weirdest calls. There was one filmmaker that wanted to put me in a boat, like with boat people leaving Vietnam, and I was supposed to shoot the boat people, and then they would have a helicopter come and pick me up and take me out. I didn't do that one.
The last question from third row.
Again, talking about the new digital world, the image itself today is getting just technically more and more perfect. It's just like very crystal clear, huge dynamic range. everything. Do you have a certain approach to just add a character, something that's alive, that feels alive to this new world of images?
All right, well, I knew I'd say something about it. look, here's my opinion. I grew up with film, and my eye is trained to see film. And then I've tried to think and analyze why the digital world looks different than the film world. You know, what's the characteristics that are different in the two mediums? And the way I have articulated, and I've had like engineers hear what I said, and they kind of confer and say that's a very good layman's way of expressing what it is. And this is the way I say it. In film, there are the three layers, RGB, red, green, blue, and they're microscopic in their differences on this film. And it's also, grain is affected by exposure. So finer grain is in highlights, and larger grain is in lower light, in underexposure. And that's constantly being affected by what you're photographing. It's changing. So it's almost, I hate to use the word organic, but it has a human quality to it. It lives. And color is separated between these grain, because the grain is affected by the RGB. And so the way color mixes with each other is not one thing or the other. It has, I like to say, there's this mixture, or there's a better word to say it, this kind of crossover between color. And in the digital world, it's pixel fixated. It's on one plane, and light is affecting electronics. It's not affecting it chemically. And so everything is in being enacted in light and dark and colors on this one film plane, or this one plane of pixels. And I think that's what gives the quality of digital a more plastic or finer grain look. Like now everyone's pushing like 4K, which to me is like just the opposite way to go. I mean, it makes our movie screens, I've seen 4K projection, and it makes a movie screen look like a giant television set. And I mean, the wonderful thing about the Alexa was that they captured something digitally that didn't look so digital. And, you know, someone said, do I always want to be looking out my window at something? You know, the beauty of film is there was a certain kind of distance between the viewer and what you're seeing. And I always felt, and I do feel as a cinematographer, I can manipulate the image better photographically than I can digitally. I don't mean later that I can do windows or, you know, change things. I'm talking about in the origination of the image. But again, like you said, things are rapidly changing. I know they're working. I can't pronounce it, where they're going to put the chips, the pixels on different planes. What's it called? A focal? There's some name for where they're going to put the RGB on different. It's not going to be pixel fixated on one plane.
Karajan would know.
What?
I think it's
maybe debiring. There's a word with an F for it.
Foveon.
That's it. Foveon.
The chip is three layers.
Yeah, three layers. So they are working on that. But I just think, look, why do we have to limit our stories to be told one way? You know, certain stories I think are wonderful told digitally, and I still like to see some films shot on film. Now, the DI process, the projection, I think is a big advance for film. But the originating the image, I still prefer film. But I'm sure it's my age, because that's the way I learned. But I think for young people starting out, not to understand the photographic process will limit them understanding how to manipulate the image. But I could be totally wrong, because they'll manipulate it in a different way, because they understand the digital world better than I do. But, you know, it's maybe like CDs versus records, you know? Just the unfortunate thing is, thank God this theater still has a film projector. You know, what's going to happen when we lose our projectors? The last lab on the East Coast of the United States has been closed. Kodak says they're going to make film for another 2 years because they have, you know, certain filmmakers in Hollywood saying that, you know, 10% of the films still in Hollywood are shot on film, and they're the biggest budget films, $100 million films, because they like the quality of it.
Yeah, thank you for this fine description of the fascination of the life of the grains. Can I call it, with Fassbinder's term, the little chaos? Can we call it the little chaos?
It has a random, to use a digital term, access, that the film is moving, and so I think that gives it a certain imagistic quality.
I'd like to close down this show with a 3-minute music video he directed for Annie Lennox as part of a tribute film to support. Oh, we have. Sorry. Okay.
Well, it's too late?
Yeah. We can show it later.
It's a masterpiece that he directed, and it's
What's going to happen?
No, the problem is, I told him it's okay, and he can close it. I'll tell you later, okay?
It doesn't matter. You can watch it on YouTube. It's called... in the afternoon, okay.
We show it in the afternoon.
All right.
Okay.
No problem.
A nice way to close this thing, but thank you anyway, and I enjoyed it so much talking to you again.